Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTVO News in Juneau here on Wednesday, the 26th of October, the year 2001. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll talk with Linda Spears of Sitka's Newark Angel Dancers featuring performers at this Saturday's Festival of Russian Culture. Tom Bryce will be here to highlight tomorrow's kickoff event for Operation Christmas Child. We'll talk with author David Vann in town for a library presentation tonight. And Anchorage pianist Dan McElrath will be here to talk about his music. Ed Writer's Almanac Music and More today on a Juneau afternoon. But with the forecast for tonight, looks like rain, low temperatures around 39 degrees. Forecast for Thursday, rain with high temperatures around 44 degrees. And forecast for Friday and Saturday and Sunday looks like rain, possibly heavy at times on Saturday.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native leaders in Manitoba, Canada, have demanded an apology from Canada's largest airline after Air Canada decided to stop using downtown Winnipeg hotels for crews. First Nations leaders are calling for their people to boycott the airline. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
The Air Canada concerns were contained in an internal airline memo. It said recent environmental issues have forced approximately 1,000 displaced people from rural Manitoba to numerous hotels in downtown Winnipeg. It added that instances of public intoxication resulting in several downtown locations being susceptible to crimes of violence and opportunity have been observed by local police. While the memo did not specifically mention Native people, most of the evacuees are from Northern Reserves. Some are still waiting to return to their flood-ravaged communities. Native leaders demanded an apology. When none came, they called for a six-month boycott of Air Canada over what they describe as a racist memo. Derek Diepenak is the Grand Chief of the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs.
When you take a population of people who are displaced due to flooding and attaching descriptors such as public intoxicant or a higher incidence of crime or exposure to crime, that's not acceptable.
Air Canada has said it did not intend to offend anyone but is sticking by its decision and has not offered any more of an apology. There are as many as 100,000 people represented by the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs. They've been asked to fly with more socially responsible air carriers. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Alaska Native men are encouraging strength and success among young men. Haven Harris is a business development specialist for the Bering Straits Native Corporation. He says young Native men need to have role models and need to be told it's okay to succeed. Harris shared that message recently with Native youth from across the state at the 2011 Elders and Youth Conference in Anchorage.
For years and years, we've had an expectation on our women to be very successful and to be very adaptive. Now we need to make our young men take those same steps and have those same expectations. And I truly believe if we place those expectations on them, they will strive to meet them. I also feel at the same time, when you place an expectation on someone and you're sincere and you're honest and you're willing to put in the time and energy to help them, they're going to strive to their very best to be successful. It doesn't necessarily just mean financially or educationally. It means being a positive member of your community and your family.
Harris, an Inupiaq Eskimo, says there are many challenges facing Alaska Native men. They have high rates of suicide and incarceration and low numbers in education and employment. He says that's why Native men need to be challenged and need to know they have value in society. Harris says having family and community support will help, and keeping connections to culture, language, and land can move Alaska Native men forward. South Dakota tribes are discussing traffic issues this week and sharing success stories. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbold reports.
The second annual Tribal Transportation Safety Summit is in its first day in Flandreau, South Dakota. Representatives of the state's nine tribes are gathering to talk about specific transportation issues. During the summit, each of the nine tribes have a chance to share a success story or best practice with the goal of showing other tribes what is working around the state. The tribes can also focus on traffic safety programs, resources, and assistance available to tribes from several state and federal groups and agencies. The first Tribal Transportation Safety Summit took place on the Lower Brule Reservation last year. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbold.
During this month in 1990, the Native American Languages Act was passed by Congress to preserve, protect, and promote the use of native languages. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support for National Native News comes from the National Library of Medicine, featuring its new interactive exhibition, Native Voices, examining the concepts of health and medicine among contemporary American Indians, Alaska Natives, and Native Hawaiians. On the web at nlm.nih.gov/native voices. The National Institutes of Health and National Cancer Institute, dedicated to improving the health of the Native American community. Funding health promotion interventions mutually developed by tribes and researchers. Learn more on how your local community can participate at www.grants.nih.gov. Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:06 and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. If you've ever been to Sitka during the summertime and you've seen a bunch of dynamic women doing some dances in Centennial Hall, you might be aware of the New Archangel Dancers. They're featured performers at this weekend's Festival of Russian Culture, starting at 4 o'clock at Centennial Hall, put on by Alexander Delitzky and friends. On the phone with me right now is Linda Spearstra from Sitka, one of the New Archangel Dancers. Linda, thank you for being on the air with me today.
Hi, Jeff. Thank you so much for inviting us.
Well, thank you for coming up to Juneau again.
Oh, we are so excited. We love to travel, and this particular performance for the Russian Festival is going to be great. The Sitniks will be up with us. They'll be performing music while we're dancing to live music, which is always, it adds so much energy.
For people who do not know, how did the New Archangel Dancers start?
Well, the New Archangels Dancers started back in 1969. There was a group of women here in Sitka that thought they would just get a little exercise, try a little dance, and, you know, as it evolved, it became more Russian folk dance and a preservation effort of the Russian history here in Sitka. Sitka was the capital of Russian America way back, you know, 140 years ago.
And you're a group of women and no men.
We have no men at this time, Jeff. When the group first started, they opened it up to all people and said, hey, why don't you come join us? And, you know, you'd have a lot of fun. You'd get some good exercise, meet some great people. And at that time, the men said, no, thank you. We did not move to Alaska to dance in our spare time. We moved here for the hunting and the fishing and the great outdoors. So this strong group of eight women just proceeded without them.
But how many performances do you do each year?
You know, the performances for the cruise ships have gone down over the last few years. So we were up to about 200 performances a summer, and last year I believe we performed about 109.
How do you select songs for your dances?
Say that one more time, Jeff. Sorry.
How do you select songs for your dances?
Oh, we have a repertoire of about 42 dances from several regions from Russia, the Ukraine, Moldova is what it's called now, Belarus, and Russia itself. So we go through that repertoire each year and select six dances for each performance for each week, and then we rotate out at a minimum two dances a week. So we shake it up.
I could just imagine some visitors come there from Russian heritage and just have tears in their eyes.
We have so many people that come out of our performances that are just astounded by what we do. They are in awe that we are here to preserve this authentic Russian history through dance. And so many have said, we did that when we were in school. And it's a wonderful feeling. And it sounds as if we are as authentic as what they are in Russia, with the exception of being an all-female troupe.
Have any of the members been to Russia?
There has been a group of members. It was before my time, so it was probably 20 years ago, a group of 6 to 8 women went to Russia. They toured Russia, did some performances. We had a sister city there, and they visited with those folks and did a couple of performances and learned a few things.
This is fantastic. You'll get the Sitniks coming doing some live music. I know you perform usually to tape music.
We normally do, and we are just so proud that the Sitniks have been able to, to come together. Several of the performers within the Sitniks are retired New Archangel dancers, so they know our music, our choreography, our steps, the tempo. They work really hard and just keep us dancing with them. We love it. They know about 10 of our songs right now, 10 of our dances.
And what are you going to be performing this weekend in Juneau?
So we'll have two sets this weekend. They'll each be 20 minutes long. So we will be performing a very traditional Russian dance called Troika, and then we'll be doing a character dance called Kalinka. And then one of our new favorites, it's pretty new for us, it's called Polyanka. The Sitniks also know it. It's an all-girls dance with some fantastic stomping work and some great solos for spinning. Additionally, we'll be doing Korobieniki, and that's a very traditional Russian dance where the dancers are showing their wares, selling their goods for the day down at the market is what we're depicting in that dance. And additionally, we will be performing in the second set, Prahotka. It's a character dance. Country girls and city girls kind of get together, and everyone's vying for a particular couple or kind of going back and forth, which is fun. We love character dances. It really shows our true personalities. We have Berioska Troika, which is a traditional Russian dance. Our gypsy dance is another favorite that we haven't performed in Juneau. And then our traditional finale, which we perform at every show in the summertime for the cruise ship season.
I know one of the highlights... One of the highlights of your show is the costume changes.
Oh, our costume changes are so much fun. We try to really shake it up. Our costumes are very authentic. The patterns come from our choreographers. The materials, we purchase from everywhere. But our group are the primary sewers, and we've made a majority of our costumes. You'll see a lot of flair, a lot of vibrant colors, real distinctive patterns, too. It's wonderful.
Well, Linda Spearstra, thank you for being on the air with us today, and look forward to seeing all of the New Archangel dancers this Saturday at the Festival of Russian Culture at 4 o'clock at Centennial Hall. The admission is by donation of $10, and if you need more information, just Google Festival of Russian Culture in Juneau and get more information that way. Linda, thank you for being on the air with me today.
Oh, thank you so much, Jeff. We really look forward to being there on Saturday.
A bit of music to get you warmed up for this Saturday's performance of the Festival of Russian Culture with the New Archangel Dancers. Time is 3:14, and you are tuned to KTWO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guests are here to talk about Operation Christmas Child with Tom Bryce, Nathaniel, and Dominica. Tom and Nathaniel and Dominica, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Jeff, thank you for having us down to talk a little bit about what's going on with Operation Christmas Child this year.
Tom, how about an overview of the plan?
Absolutely. First of all, for those who aren't aware of it, Operation Christmas Child is an effort by Samaritan's Purse, which is an international relief organization. It's a Christian-based international relief organization headed by Franklin Graham. Operation Christmas Child is their efforts to get kids in developing and third world nations a little bit of hope, a little bit of something for Christmas. It's the plan is you pack a shoebox, you deliver it up to Chapel by the Lake, and we make sure that the big OCC organization gets them and gets it delivered out across the world. They put all sorts of things, candy and toys and dolls and whatnot into the shoe boxes, and it's just a real opportunity to let a little kid out in, you know, the more difficult parts of the world to know that somebody cares about them. And that's why I brought Miss Buck with us today, is she actually received shoe boxes as a young child. And can you tell us a little bit about what that meant to you?
Yeah, sure. I used to receive those boxes normally for Christmas, and it often meant a lot because Slovakia is a poor country, and I came from a poor family. And so often when I received this box, it was just very nice because, like, we didn't really have many gifts for Christmas. And so it was just really nice to get it and all the gifts that were in the boxes and the stuff. And it was so special because it was from America and it was different than what we had in Slovakia. So, yeah, it was really nice to get it.
Now, Miss Buck she met her husband over in Slovakia, and they've come over, and they'll be at a big Operation Christmas Child kickoff event tomorrow night over at Chapel by the Lake in Smith Hall, starting at 6:00. Dominica will be there talking a little bit more about, you know, what shoeboxes mean, Operation Christmas Child shoeboxes mean to kids that receive them. We'll also have some special guests from out of town, other people who have received shoeboxes, and also the Western Regional Director, Ileana Salazar, will be there as well. And for folks who would like to know a little bit more about it or participate or find out what packing shoeboxes means, come on out to Chapel by the Lake tomorrow night at 6:00. And we'll have light desserts, coffee, and a real opportunity to sit down and talk in depth about what this effort is all about.
And there's a couple things about the shoeboxes themselves. You're not exactly sure what country they'll be going to.
We're not sure. Last year, a lot of them went to Haiti. A lot went to Philippines. Where else? I've also heard that a number of them went to Africa. The neat thing is you go to Operation Christmas Child website. They have a program that you can do, which is print off your own label. And it gives you a computer code, and they link that computer code to your email. It's called EasyGive, and you can track your shoebox. And people in Juneau had their shoeboxes, as I was saying, hit all around the world. The people, the countries that I mentioned were just a couple of the countries that I've heard that Juneau boxes went to. Some things to bear in mind when you're packing shoe boxes, liquids are a no-no, hard candy, absolute, yes. If you're going to pack hard candy and sweets, make sure you throw a toothbrush and toothpaste in there, you know. Dominica, what was one of the things that you really appreciated in your shoe boxes?
Yeah, I used to get toys. I used to get also like soap or even toothpaste, and even that was special because it was different. It was from America. and maybe some piece of clothes like socks or T-shirt or something.
Yeah. Was there a particular gift that you really appreciated?
Yeah, I got this little stuffed toy. It was little frog, and he's been very good friend to me. His name is Jimmy, and I got it probably 12 years ago, or 11, doesn't matter. And he even moved with me from Slovakia to here, so he's a really, really good friend.
You know, Jeff, this is really an effort that reaches, you know, across all the Juneau community as well as throughout southeastern Alaska. You know, we have AML that's just wonderful to work with in terms of helping to coordinate, you know, all the boxes from the outlying communities to come into Juneau so where we can do the final inventory and packing out here and at Chapel. You also have Tyler Rentals that's done a lot in terms of, you know, donating equipment to help with the packing. And a special, you know, thank you goes to McDonald's. One of the things that that they've been really good about over the years is donating their little Happy Meal toys that are really nice to put in, you know, the shoe boxes as well. And so they've been doing a lot. But we're dealing with, you know, we've got over 20 churches in Juneau with probably another dozen different secular groups out there that participate. And so if your organization, if you're part of an organization that might think that they might like to participate in the OCC effort, they should go ahead and just give me a yell, Tom Bryce, at 586-8274, and we can get them hooked up.
And tomorrow night is the kickoff night?
Tomorrow night is the kickoff night. It's, as I was saying, we're going to have supplies, materials, everything that folks will need, you know, in terms of when to bring their boxes and where to bring their boxes. The official collection week is November 13th through the 21st. So throughout that week, from 1 p.m. on the Sunday the 13th through 4 p.m. on Monday the 21st, you can bring your packed boxes to Chapel by the Lake and follow the signs there in Smith Hall. We'll have a special center set up for people to drop off and, you know, leave the boxes, and we'll get them recorded, and there'll be a little bit of paperwork, nothing too much. But then on Sunday, November 20th, the day before the last day that we accept boxes, we'll have a big inventory box packing day out at Chapel by the Lake as well. And that's when we bring in all the boxes from Haines and Skagway, Wrangell, Petersburg, Sitka, Ketchikan, Prince of Wales Island. We'll come in, we'll count them, put them in the cartons, and get them prepped to be shipped overseas. From Juneau, they'll go down to Orange County, California, where there's a special processing center. It'll be processed there, repacked, and then sent overseas. Then usually 2 to 3 months later, if people participate in the Easy Give program, they'll start getting emails as to where their boxes go.
And they don't have to be cardboard boxes. They can be plastic boxes as well.
You hit the nail on the head, Jeff. We have a limited supply of decorative small shoe boxes that are nice and cute and everything else. But, you know, Juneau being a fishing community, I've heard people, you know, packing up fishing boxes, tackle boxes that are about the same size as a shoe box and use that. A lot of people will go over to one of the stores and pick up, you know, the Rubbermaid storage boxes that are about the size of a shoe box and pack those. And, you know, those are pretty neat because the folks on the other end, the boxes in and of themselves are a gift.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's pretty useful as well, as we've heard. We don't know where the boxes are going when we pack them. So, you know, it's kind of, you know, don't worry about it. Put whatever in that you want to put in. And it's funny how things tend to work out that they get to the kids that need them the most. And, you know, that it's really a neat way to you know, help a kid out in out in the world that, you know, might not feel that anybody even knows that they exist.
And that kickoff date is tomorrow night at Whitechapel by Lake. What time is that?
At 6 p.m. And come on out, show up a few minutes early. We'd like to get the program started right at 6. It's probably about an hour long, you know, but we've got Smith Hall reserved for an hour and a half and plenty of parking, easy access, you know, easy access, and you know, as I was saying, there's always free desserts out there, so that's always something that gets the my teenage boys over, gets them a little bit interested in these types of activities too. But it'll be a fun time, Jeff, you know, and it's a real opportunity. You know, quite often we might send a check to, you know, one relief organization or another relief organization, and that money goes into a big pot and nobody ever knows what happens to it. With OCC and with this event, we're going to put a few faces with the boxes and with what you're doing. And I think that's really powerful in terms of, you know, having a real impact. You know, Dominica, what were those boxes? What did those boxes mean to you? How did they help you along?
To me, it meant that there is someone in the world, far away, that actually really cares about me and loves me. And what I would encourage you all to put little picture of you to the box or little note that, you know, there is many children in the world who don't have parents. They will get this little box, and they will actually, you might be the only family they will ever have. I've heard of stories that the children actually keep the pictures and, you know, just they keep it and it's precious to them. So, really, it means a lot. And to me, it showed also the love of Jesus, that people just, I don't know, just love is powerful, so...
All right, yeah. Dominica and Nathaniel and also Tom. All right, Bryce, thank you for coming in today and talking about Operation Christmas Child. Tom, phone number one more time, please.
If people like more information on packing or materials, Tom Bryce, 586-8274.
Thank you for coming down to the station today.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
When I was just a wee little lad, full of health and joy, my father homeward came one night and gave to me a toy. A wonder to behold it was, with many colors bright. The moment I laid eyes on it, it became my heart's delight. It went zip when it moved and bop when it stopped and whirr when it stood still. I never knew just what it was, and I guess I never will. The first time that I picked it up, I had a big surprise, for right on the bottom were two big buttons that looked like big green eyes. I first pushed one and then the other, then I twisted its lid. When I set it down again, this is what it did. It went zip when it moved and bop when it stopped and whirr when it stood still. I never knew just what it was, and I guess I never will. It first marched left and then marched right, then marched under a chair. And when I looked where it had gone, it wasn't even there. I started to cry and my daddy laughed, for he knew that I would find. When I turned around, my marvelous toy chugging from behind. It went zip when it moved and bop when it stopped, whirr when it stood still. I never knew just what it was, and I guess I never will. Well, the years have gone by too quickly, it seems. I have my own little boy, And yesterday I gave to him a marvelous little toy. His eyes nearly popped right out of his head. He gave a squeal of glee. Neither one of us knows just what it is, but he loves it just like me. It still goes bit when it moves and bop when it stops, whirr when it stands still. I never knew just what it was, and I guess I never will.
Tom Paxton, the time is 3:30, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. Next guest is David Vann. He's the author. He's come out with several novels. One of them is called Legend of a Suicide, a collection of short stories, and his latest one is called Caribou Island. He's going to be doing a library presentation tonight, and he's going to be visiting with students from the Johnson Youth Center tomorrow. David, thank you for coming down to the station today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So you were born in the Aleutian Islands in Mason, Ketchikan.
Yeah. Yeah, I lived in Ketchikan until I was about 5 1/2. And so my earliest memories are there. Earliest memories are of days like today with rain and hanging out in the rainforest. And to me, that rainforest became a big part of my writing. Legend of a Suicide, most of that is set in Southeast Alaska and is told through the landscape. So the inside lives of the characters and the stories come through description of the Alaskan landscape. And then Caribou Island is set up on the Kenai Peninsula, a place that I've gone to a lot. And I guess I love describing wilderness because I think it's it doesn't have any meaning on its own. It's kind of like a blank slate for the unconscious to fill. It's a place that can shift and become strange. So to give an example, when I was late in the book in Caribou Island, Irene, the main character, is running through the forest, and she feels like the earth is tilting under her feet, and the island is top-heavy with all the rock and trees, and it's going to turn over. And that's one of those crazy moments where the landscape shifts and shows the inside life of the character. So for both of these books, when I was writing them, all I was doing was trying to see Alaska each day and describe it.
They aren't happy books, are they?
No, I don't really come from a happy family. We have 5 suicides and a murder in my family, and 4 of us have sunk boats, and we've had lots of business disasters and divorces. It's actually fantastic training for a writer. I recommend it. We had this combination of growing up in a beautiful place like Ketchikan and having all these disasters in the family. And then my family is also a bunch of liars about small things like the size of fish and then big things like who was responsible for whose suicide. So that the combination of those elements was actually pretty good for telling stories.
Your book, Legend of a Suicide, was refused to be shopped around by agents for 12 years, and finally it became an international bestseller, translated in how many languages?
17.
That's quite a number of languages.
Yeah, I couldn't get it published forever. For 12 years, no agent would send it to editors because they thought just no one would want to buy it. The title had suicide in it, Legend of a Suicide. It has a strange format where it's a short novel framed by 5 stories, and it was set in Alaska, which is regional. And so just no one was interested. And I finally sent it to a contest. Well, first, as I couldn't get published, I went to sea and I became a captain on sailboats and eventually became an aluminum boat builder and had a completely other life and thought I would never get published. And then I finally sent it to a contest, the Associated Writing Programs in the U.S., and it was published through that. And so I got lucky. And it was a small book with only 3 reviews, but one of them was a New York Times book review. And they devoted a full page to it and really tried to give it a life, and they did. And that's what changed my life. That's why it's coming out in 17 languages. So I'm really grateful to them. And also the Anchorage Daily News. Mike Dunham has covered all the books. He was one of the 3 reviews for Legend of a Suicide and has done a lot for me and for other Alaskan writers.
Do you think you're appreciated more internationally than domestically?
Yeah, definitely. I actually sell more copies in Catalan, in just one part of Spain, than I do in the U.S. I do better in every other territory than I do in the U.S.
What do you imagine reading your books when you're writing them?
I don't imagine anyone. I actually, writing's very unconscious for me. When I sit down each day, I don't know what the characters will do or say. I don't know what the story's about. I don't know where it will go or what will happen. And I just find out each day. And I think of writing as an act of transformation of the unconscious, that I have these crappy family stories, a lot of them from a long time ago, like 30 years ago. And those have been stewing for a long time in me. And if I describe the landscape, if I describe Alaska, these stories find a way of coming out in some other form. And I feel like what the unconscious does actually is an act of transformation, like an act that it does in the world in making that story, which is a distortion of what happened in real life. It ends up being fictional. It's different than what happened. But there's a kind of truth in it, or revelation, or redemption in some way. I'm not religious, but I feel like redemption is maybe the right word, where it's a kind of second chance, and what was ugly before is made into something else that can be beautiful at times. So, I don't imagine an audience. I just find out what the story is, and then that's what it is. And the way it's published is almost the same as my first draft. Caribou Island has almost no revision. I added 7 or 8 paragraphs of background material, less than 1,000 words, and that was it. But otherwise, this is the way it came out in 5.5 months of writing every day.
One of the things that I noticed while I was reading Caribou Island, there's no quotation marks, so you can't really tell when people are talking. Is that on purpose?
Yeah, a lot of writers do that, like Cormac McCarthy, and I had a class with Grace Paley, who's a really good short story writer, does that. And the reason I don't use them is that I don't think they're necessary. I don't think they do anything. You can tell who's talking just from what they're saying, and I use little tags like, you know, my father said, or he said, or she said, which is the same as how you tell if you have quotation marks, actually. And I think that there's something artificial about quotation marks. It comes from this idea that in fiction, what people do or say is true and real, but what they think might not be real, might be suspect. But that whole thing is an idiotic idea, because all of it is a dream. All of it is fictional. So everything relates to the main character, the protagonist in the book. So that means just the existence of the other characters is a reflection of the main character. And what they do and say is all a reflection of that character. And the description of a landscape tells us about that character. So the whole thing is one dream. There is no real and not real within fiction. The whole thing is a dream. So I think quotation marks are a convention that's purposeless, that will, you know, fall away over time within fiction. In nonfiction, we still use it because we're responsible for what people actually said, and it has to be accurate, and we can be held responsible for whether or not we were accurate. So we use quotation marks there.
You've answered that question before.
Yeah, I have, and I write nonfiction and fiction. So I have a new book out that just came out about a school shooting called Last Day on Earth. And in that, I'm very careful to use quotation marks to indicate sources, you know, what came from where, who said what, and I made sure it's all accurate. You know, the whole book is a mountain of facts, and nothing's made up. So it's very different than fiction in that way.
I'm talking to author David Vann. He's going to be talking tonight at the Juneau Public Library downtown version about Caribou Island, doing a reading, and that's out at 6 o'clock, and it's free. What else are you going to be doing today? Signing copies of your books, I imagine?
Yeah, I'll sign copies afterward. I'm really excited to come back. I haven't been to Juneau for a while. It's nice to be back in Southeast. And I'll be talking about Caribou Island and Legend of Suicide, both set in Alaska, and then I'll also talk about Last Day on Earth, about the school shooting. What was strange about the school shooting is that I was actually able to get the 1,500 pages of the police file. So it has all of his emails and his mental health history and his military history and juvenile record. It's really a complete portrait of all the information available about this particular school shooter. So that was a very different experience. And I've written a lot for magazines. This initially was an article for Esquire magazine. So at the reading, I'm happy to answer questions about writing fiction or nonfiction. It's been a strange, screwy kind of writing life that I've had. I wouldn't recommend my career path to anyone, but it's been interesting.
Tomorrow, you're talking with youth from the Johnson Youth Center. Why are you going there?
It's something that Jonas Lamb set up from the public library here, and I'm grateful to him for bringing me up here. It's part of a tour also to Ketchikan and Anchorage and Fairbanks. And in each location, we tried to find some other venues that I could read in, also schools or where I'm going tomorrow. And I think it'll be interesting as a discussion, because I just wrote this book about the school shooting, and in the book about the school shooting, I included my own memoir, my own growing up with guns. After my father killed himself with a pistol, my family gave me all of his guns. So I had a whole arsenal in my closet, including shotguns and a 300 Magnum for bears. And I wandered around our neighborhood with that gun, and I shot out street lamps, and I aimed at the neighbors. And part of the question, one of the questions I ask in the book is why I ended up not crossing the line and hurting someone, and why this guy did cross that line. And so I don't really view, you know, getting in trouble as being something that's entirely different than not getting in trouble. Like, in other words, I don't believe in an innate goodness in me. I think that there were circumstances and opportunities, and I was lucky in various ways. And I found the book about the school shooter very scary to write because there was a lot that was identifiable in him.
David Venn will be talking tonight at 6 o'clock at the Downtown Library. And have copies of his book available for sale and autographing as well. David, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 26th of October, 2011. It's the birthday of the playwright John Arden, born in Barnsley, England, 1930, best known for his play Sergeant Musgrave's Dance. It's the birthday of Hillary Rodham Clinton, born in Chicago, 1947, the daughter of a man who sold draperies and was so frugal that even on the coldest winter nights in Illinois, he would turn the heat in the house off and then wake up early in the morning to warm the house back up before everyone else arose. It was a middle-class suburb, Chicago. The girl played sports. She wrote for the student newspaper, participated in student government. Her father was a Republican. She was, too, campaigned for Barry Goldwater in the 1964 presidential election. First year in college, she was president of the Wellesley Young Republican Student Group. But influenced by the civil rights movement, the war in Vietnam, she changed her views, and as a junior in college, she campaigned for Eugene McCarthy on an anti-war platform. It was on this day, 1900, Henry James wrote his first letter to the young novelist Edith Wharton, beginning a long friendship. Wharton was an admirer of James's work. She sent him one of the first short stories she ever wrote. He wrote back to say that he liked the story, but she shouldn't write about Europe if she didn't live there. He said, "Be tethered in native pastures, even if it reduces you to a backyard in New York." So she was inspired to write about New York, and the result was her first big novel, The House of Mirth, in 1905. They remained friends for the rest of Henry James's life, even as Edith Wharton became more and more successful and Henry James's novels sold less and less well. It's the birthday of the Russian novelist and poet Andrei Bely, which was the pen name of Boris Nikolaevich Bagayev. Born Moscow, 1880, best known for his 1913 novel, Petersburg, a book of which Nabokov said, "My greatest masterpieces of 20th century prose are Joyce's Ulysses, Kafka's Transformations, Bailey's Petersburg, a story of conspiracy and betrayal during the 1905 Russian Revolution." It's the birthday of Beryl Markham, born in Leicester, England, 1902 on this day. Moved to Kenya when she was just 3 years old. Grew up on a farm there, learned to speak several African languages, learned to hunt wild game with a spear, became a successful horse trainer. And then she took up flying. She wanted to become a bush pilot. And in 1936, she set out to fly from London west to New York City, against the prevailing winds, which no one else had dared do. She flew a single-engine Vega Gull. It carried extra fuel tanks, could go almost 4,000 miles, almost crashed over the Atlantic when a fuel line froze, and then the fuel line froze again just off the edge of Nova Scotia, and she crash-landed in a peat bog. She wrote a book about it called West with the Night. Here's a poem for today by David R. Slavitt, A Cat's Life. Her repertoire is limited but fulfilling, with two preoccupations or three, perhaps, if you include the taking of many naps. Otherwise, she is snuggling or killing. A Cat's Life by David R. Slavitt, from William Henry Harrison and Other Poems, published by Louisiana State University Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, where your mobile device can turn into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's Poetry app. You can find it online at poetryfoundation.org. And by CSX, transporting 2 billion pounds of goods to market by train, working to help move the economy forward. CSX, How Tomorrow Moves. Edited by Noah Smith. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The music of Anchorage-based musician Dan McElrath. He's a pianist and also a piano tuner, and he's in the studio with us today. Dan, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thanks for inviting me.
So piano tuner first and a pianist second?
Unfortunately, that's the way it's working out. Yeah, here in Alaska, it's tough to make a good living just doing music, and so I had to find something to support my addiction to playing.
Tell me about piano tuning. Do you have to tune to pianos but do different to the desires of different people?
Yeah, the tuning sometimes is a little bit different, but more than that, the voicing, the tonal color of the piano, and the action of the piano and the mechanics of it. Different artists like pianos refine certain ways to their preferences.
Do they tell you how they like it ahead of time, or do you just kind of do a little reading with them first?
Sometimes they have it in their concert writer, what it is they're expecting from the piano, and then other times they just talk to you about it when they come. They're usually there several days before the performance working out on the piano, so they get a good sense of what it's got.
So there's specific terms for these tunings that you do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for the different parts of what we're changing. When you're changing the tone color of the piano, it's called voicing. And when you're changing the mechanics of it and the speed and the repetition of the action, it's called regulation. Yeah.
What might a pianist look for as far as voicing?
Well,
I'm looking for a couple of tech talk terms.
Okay. Well, as a technician, what we're looking for is dynamic range. And by that, what we mean is we want a piano, when someone's playing softly, to have just this beautiful, warm, resonant sound. And when they really bear down and play it, we want it to be very edgy and just kind of blow their hair back and have the color to be able to do all of those things. So if you voice a piano to where it's a little too bright or too edgy, you lose some of that warmth and mellowness on the bottom end, and vice versa. If someone, you know, is really wanting it to be a more darker sounding instrument, you're going to lose some of the power on the top end. So trying to find the full tonal spectral color, if you want to call it that, of the piano is kind of what the technician's job is.
Was piano your first instrument?
It's my only instrument, yes.
Your stepfather was a piano player, a jazz piano player?
That's right, uh-huh. Yeah, my mom married him when I was 5, and I kind of started messing around, learning a little bit about the piano, kind of trying to imitate him and emulate him when I was 8, and started kind of working my way up from there. And I was a late bloomer, but I got there eventually.
You tuned Garrison Keillor's piano this summer.
Yeah, he was up. That was the third time I've actually tuned it. I tuned it last time he was here, I think, too. And he's been in Anchorage at the Performing Arts Center before. I've done it for him there, and And then he was at the state fair this year, doing his romance tour or love tour. I don't remember what it was called, but ended up being an absolutely gorgeous sunny day at the fair that day, and it was a treat. It was fun.
What kind of things does the sun do to a tuned piano?
Not good things. Fortunately, it was sitting on the stage, and we had it baffled so that the sun actually didn't touch it. But instantaneously, whenever I do an outdoor tuning, especially on a grand piano, the sunlight, when it hits the strings, immediately warms them. And as they warm, they expand, and the piano goes flat almost instantaneously. So it's pretty important when you're tuning and when performances are going on that you try and keep that from happening.
How do you get started tuning pianos as opposed to just playing them?
Well, my stepdad actually tuned pianos a little bit, and he bought one of these old strobe tuners. You ever see one of those? Mm-hmm. They used to use them in band rooms in high schools and stuff. He played on so many very poorly tuned pianos, he kind of taught himself how to use that thing to get them in the ballpark. And as a teenager, he taught me how to use that thing, and I started kind of messing around. And early on, I just thought everybody that played piano tuned their own piano. I mean, everybody that plays everything else tunes their own instrument. And I just suspected that to be the case as well. But I found out as I got older that wasn't the case. So I did it more or less just kind of as a side job as I went through college and I was in the military for a while. I didn't know anyone made a real living tuning pianos. And until in the early 90s, I got a call from George Winston. He was coming to Alaska and doing a tour, and he was looking for a technician to travel with him. And I got exposed to what concert level technical work is all about on that tour, Baptized by Fire, I guess. And it was very intriguing. It was much more interesting to me than just going in a home with your little strobe tuner and, you know, sitting down and tuning it up. So learned a lot about it, and then got real involved in the Piano Technicians Guild International, and went to the Steinway School in New York, and Yamaha has a factory school also. I went to that and got all the concert training and learned how to do all of that, and that's what I get to do most of the time now. It's a fun job. Meet lots of great people.
So you're based out of Anchorage?
Yes.
If I was going to go to Anchorage, where would I go to be certain to find some live jazz?
Oh, not a lot of places. There's only one place you would be guaranteed to find live jazz, and that would be at Sullivan Steakhouse, which is on the it's downtown on the corner of the Fifth Avenue Mall. I think it's C Street and Fifth, right on the corner there. And every night there's some kind of jazz going on there. The Taproot in Anchorage and Spinard has jazz on. I think they have blues on Sunday night, and regular jazz on Monday nights. And then occasionally there'll be other groups there, but those are the two main jazz nights. That's the only thing that happens on a... Well, I take that back. There's one other place called Sub-Zero. It's a small bar behind Humpy's that they've transformed into a nice little jazz scene. And I think Thursday, Fridays, and Saturdays they tend to have jazz there.
And you and your wife are in town for tuning pianos. She's a piano tuner as well?
She is, yeah. She started doing this about 3-4 years ago, and she's doing very well. And it's really nice to be able to travel together and do this as a team.
What does it take to be a good piano player? Do you have a good strobe or a good ear or both?
To be a good piano tuner?
Mm-hmm.
To be a good piano tuner, it certainly takes a good ear, but it's... the art of tuning a piano is the art of compromise, learning how to compromise and get the best compromise possible. If you are too much of a perfectionist, piano tuning is a very frustrating job because you can never get a piano exactly perfect because there's so many anomalies. It's kind of like being a human being. We all have flaws. No matter how hard we try to eliminate them, they're always going to be there. And pianos, there's a lot of parallels between pianos and people, and you try to just get them to produce the best they possibly can and be happy with the results.
Earlier on the show today, we featured folks talking about the Operation Christmas Child, which sends shoeboxes of toys and goods to kids around the world. And coincidentally, you have a new CD out that's Christmas music here in the middle of October.
I do. Well, we actually recorded it last year and had hoped to get it released by Christmas of last year, but due to several art problems and other things, we didn't get our hands on the CD until like a couple of days before Christmas, and it was a little late then. So we've been selling it all year, but we're working at really promoting it here coming up on the Christmas season this year. so people can get a hold of it. It's called An Alaskan Christmas.
And the name of your CD is the you pronounce that CD Alaska Jazz or Alaska Jazz?
Ajaska?
Ajaska.
Yeah, yeah. The Ajaska was the CD that we did before the Alaskan Christmas CD.
Let's hear Greensleeves, okay, if you could, please.
Yeah, you want to pull that up here.
Music of Dan McElrath from his Christmas CD, which is out and available through his website. Dan, can you tell us what your website is, please?
Yeah, it's available on iTunes. It's available on cdbaby.com, and it's also available on our website at danmacjazz.net. It's danmacjazz.net.
All right, Dan McElrath, thank you very much for coming down to the station today and talking about jazz and your career.
Thanks for having me in.
A little bit of the music in the background of the group Sweet Plantain. They'll be appearing at the Junior Douglas High School Auditorium this Friday night in a concert brought to you by the Juno Arts and Humanities Council. Tickets are available by going to their website at jahc.org. You are tuned to KTUO in Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. KTUO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Ock Bay area, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Chris Davis listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT Sirsuna at 91.9. An excursion inlet in Icy Strait, you can hear KTUO on K210 AS 89.9. And in Juno, you can also receive KTUO on GCI Cable Juno on digital channel 871. We're also online at www.ktuo.org. Coming up tomorrow on a Juno afternoon, we'll find out about the Fun Fall Fest at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center this Saturday with guests Jane Terry, Irene Morris, and Nikki Hines. Kyle Pickett will be here to talk about the Juno Symphony's production this weekend of Sweeney Todd. We'll talk to Alexander Dolitsky about his new book, Living Wisdom of the Far North. And Nancy DeTrini will be here at the news and views about local arts activities during Arts Up. It's tomorrow at 3 here on KTUO News. With the forecast for tonight, looks like rain showers, low temperatures around 38 degrees. Forecast for Thursday looks like rain with high temperatures around 43 degrees. Friday, cloudy skies and a chance of rain. It looks like Saturday and Saturday night, rain likely with high temperatures 4 to 44 degrees. Thank you for tuning in to Juno Afternoon today. Coming up next is All Things Considered. Have a great evening.
Now is the time for the European leadership collectively to take decisions to end the uncertainty.
That plea for European unity from the Prime Minister of Greece, where the debt crisis started. For Wednesday, October 26th, it's All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Coming up, the EU summit.
European leaders set out to reach a comprehensive deal on the debt crisis, but are ratcheting back expectations.
Also this hour, new rules from the Obama administration designed to make it easier for college graduates to repay student loans.
And after many delays, the inaugural flight of the Boeing 787.
Bigger windows, wings that flex, and this.
I've never seen such a long line for an aircraft bathroom before. Everyone wanted to check out the bathroom and use it. Part of it is there's a window in there, which is just really cool.
Now this news.